Orville Wright did it 100 years ago tomorrow, braving heavy rain and wind and lying flat across the lower wing of his biplane. He took to the air above Kitty Hawk Beach in North Carolina for an astonishing 12 seconds. Now we're all defying gravity, and it's not about one passenger anymore. In the UK alone, we take 180 million flights a year. According to the Transport Secretary, Alistair Darling, that'll be more like 500 million within 30 years, which provides the rationale for today's white paper on aviation, setting out the government's case for more runways and airport expansions. But is the plane a curse or a blessing? And is cheap flight really as cheap as we think?
In December 2003, the British government published its Future of Air Transport white paper to a storm of controversy. It was widely criticised by a range of individuals, organisations and pressure groups, both within Parliament and outside, for its apparent failure to properly address the environmental impacts of aviation and for the predictions which it made about growth in demand for flying and the decisions that were subsequently made on that premise. This three-part programme critically examines the background and context which led up to the initiation of the white paper, the research and consultation exercise that was subsequently undertaken, and the policy decisions which ultimately were presented in the white paper itself. You're listening to part one, which looks at how the major issues addressed by the consultation were decided upon and how the process was formulated. Mike Fawcett was head of the Airports Policy Division at the Department for Transport from September 1996 until the end of 2003. He had the overall responsibility for the production of the Future of Air Transport white paper. He describes the factors that led the government to initiate the white paper process.
I think in many ways the immediate motivation and prompt for the white paper was the report by the Transport Select Committee of the House of Commons in 1996, which sort of recommended that there was a need for an up-to-date air transport policy, and particularly on airports. And there were many reasons for that. I mean, one was that the aviation industry wanted to have a framework within which it could plan. It was also sort of important that people living around airports, local residents, should sort of know what the future might hold. And also so that we could have a more strategic approach to the development of aviation and airports, with a sort of long-term, broad plan, not a sort of Stalinist five-year plan, but a sort of broad strategy for the long term, so that it was sort of less piecemeal, perhaps, than hitherto. And I think one of the things that sharpened that in the late 1990s was the experience with the Terminal 5 inquiry, where there was perceived to be a rather an absence of government policy framework, which meant that there was a lot of time spent in the inquiry trying to establish, well, what is the government policy? What is the framework within which this planning inquiry about one particular development was taking place? So, I mean, for a number of things came together to suggest that it would be a good idea to have a long-term strategy.
Peter Ainsworth, MP, is chair of the Commons Environmental Audit Committee, which was highly critical of the white paper. He believes there were other forces at work behind the initiation of the white paper.
I think the whole process was driven by the desire of the industry to see very significant expansion in its capacity and clearly in its profits in the end. Well, I've nothing against that, but it's the government's job to look at all the issues involved, approach it in a way that balances the competing interests. I guess it was probably time to look again at aviation. I mean, there hadn't been any major policy initiatives in that sector for a long time. And I certainly believe that the industry, you know, had interesting and valuable points to make, and one should always listen to that. But I fear what happened was that the impulse, being the industry's own commercial interests in expanding and growing, from the moment the process began, it was tilted in a certain direction. And people who wanted it tilted in an alternative direction were just not really, they were not listened to in a way that altered the basic course which the government had set out on when it began the process.
There's certainly no doubt that the massive growth of the aviation industry had put pressure on the government for a clear policy on the expansion of aviation.
The airline industry was deregulated and sort of fairly competitive in the late 1990s, but rapidly becoming more competitive with the growth of the low-cost airlines, really turning the industry upside down. And also, of course, being a sort of big driver of growth in capacity and increasing shortages of airport capacity as a result of the low-cost carriers rapidly using up the available capacity. And on the airport side, there was also a sort of tendency and a move during perhaps the 1990s as a whole to more privately owned airports and a more active competition between airports, not uniformly across the country. Clearly BAA is still in a very strong position in the southeast market, but certainly an increased level of competition between airports around the country. And so that was another factor that had changed quite a lot since the previous white paper, which was 1985, and I mean, which was famously described during the Terminal 5 inquiry as getting a bit yellow around the edges.
While not disputing the factors behind the growth in the aviation industry, Peter Ainsworth suggests that the government seems to have looked at aviation in isolation from other major policy areas.
Well, I think the thing that they should have looked at right at the start was the way in which the growth in aviation, which obviously has been massive over recent years, is compatible with other very important government objectives, in particular their objectives on climate change. And I don't believe that that was factored in. I think what we saw was a reaction to consumer demand for virtually unlimited travel and the pressures that that was putting on infrastructure and capacity, particularly in the southeast, and not a holistic view of how all this fitted in with other bits of government policy. Clearly, I mean, demand for air travel has risen astronomically. It's still actually quite a young industry. If you think of when package holidays started, it's only about 35 years ago. So if you look at the graph of air travel, it's gone shooting up. And I think there was an assumption that it would continue in the same kind of trajectory. Now, I don't know. I believe, in fact, that assumption was not challenged. And I think that should have been factored in much earlier on as well.
So how much did the government's own policy on climate change feature in the initiation stages of the process? Mike Fawcett again.
That was probably not a very major factor in the decision to start the process, which was taken sort of back in late 90s. A commitment to start the studies of airports leading to the white paper was set out in John Prescott's 1998 Transport White Paper. But the emerging policy on global warming and carbon emissions was certainly a very important factor that was changing during the sort of process of developing the white paper on air transport, was a sort of very major topic of debate amongst the various stakeholders and also, of course, within government. And that became a very big factor in the process of developing the policy that led to the white paper.
But even when climate change had become a major topic of debate, Mike Fawcett claims that the global effects of aviation were judged best dealt with at a global level, and that other important national interests had to be addressed.
The debates that led to the policy in the white paper did take place at a lot of levels. The thinking about global warming was a good example of that, because it's a problem that is global. And I think there was a sort of large measure of agreement among the sort of actors in the UK that it was a problem best tackled at a global level through global agreements. And particularly in aviation, a lot of things are decided through global agreements, and it's jolly difficult to change them at any lower level. But equally, this was a very important white paper for sort of national policy, and both in terms of sort of economic growth in the UK and meeting the aspirations of UK citizens, but also affecting in all sorts of ways the environment in the UK in a very big way. And also, of course, at a regional level, affecting regional growth, regional development, thinking about the balance of economic growth in the north and south of the UK, the sort of aspirations of regions for growth, which are very different in different parts of the UK. And at a local level, obviously, for many people, absolutely critical. People living close to airports, extremely concerned about noise and pollution and traffic and other factors. So it was sort of complex set of issues at a lot of different levels.
Chris Kane worked with Mike Fawcett in the Airports Policy Division of the Department for Transport and initially had responsibility for the programme of preparatory studies informing preparation of the white paper across the UK.
The industry impacts at all these different levels, and there are different issues that happen at these different spatial levels. And actually approaches and views are different as you go between the different levels. And actually what you're ending up having to do is not simply trying to decide a global issue or a local issue, but balance off these different spatial dimensions to the particular problems that you're dealing with. And it's a very complicated process.
And pressure was building on the government from the aviation industry itself, as Mike Fawcett explains.
I think there was certainly an urgency about running out of capacity, particularly runway capacity, and particularly at some of the main airports in the southeast of England. They weren't the only ones, but they were perhaps some of the ones that were concerning a lot of people. And not just people in the southeast, but often regions who depended on connections to the major London airports for their sort of connections to other parts of the world. And for instance, people in Scotland very concerned about the effects on economic growth if connections to Heathrow in particular became sort of less good.
Peter Ainsworth doesn't disagree.
It seems in retrospect that the government was under considerable pressure from the aviation industry, from airport owners and from airlines themselves to increase capacity, because that industry had been growing extremely fast, wanted to grow faster, and felt that there were going to be constraints on their ability to grow unless something changed, unless we had a considerable expansion. And that's where the pressure was coming from. And that is the pressure to which the government has responded.
Ainsworth also thinks that some of the pressure was because the aviation industry felt it might lose out to European competition if something wasn't done to increase capacity in the UK.
I think the UK aviation industry was concerned, and remain rightly, from their point of view, concerned about competition from other airports within Europe, Schiphol in particular, and didn't want to see the UK losing out. With big expansions going on just over the channel and finding that we were kind of becoming a poor relation in terms of capacity and their industry's ability to compete. Those are perfectly legitimate issues for the aviation industry to raise, but it's of course the government's job to filter those representations through its policy objectives overall and to come out with something which is balanced and consistent. And I think that's what failed to happen.
Whatever the pressures and the context within which the white paper process started, historically it was a new departure from the way airport planning had been carried out hitherto. Chris Kane.
They had basically had to go through the standard planning procedures that would apply to any kind of major development. Another example, Terminal 5 is the classic one that everybody's aware of, but there was the Manchester Second Runway Inquiry was another example of that. And for most types of significant development at an airport, whether you look at something like a runway extension or a new terminal, they are big developments. They're significant, the impacts are significant, and therefore would be subject to an awful lot of scrutiny. But there was effectively, things were being dealt with on an ad hoc basis as they came forward. It's kind of a laissez-faire approach. You'd have to make the case at specific airports based on specific local factors. There was no overarching strategy about where the best place to develop new capacity would be, what the best way of managing that that process of development, how best to look at mitigating impacts. All of those things were being dealt with on a case-by-case basis rather than in a broad structure.
Despite the fact that the new process was recognition of the need for a cohesive approach to aviation planning, Peter Ainsworth still found it flawed.
They went about it in quite an interesting way, in that they did it on a regional basis initially. And that seemed to me at the time quite odd, because it's hard to justify something which is clearly of national, and indeed if you take its environmental impacts, of global importance, being broken down and dealt with on a regional basis. And so you had all these different regional inquiries and consultations going on, which didn't actually refer to each other. That was a flaw, I think, in the way that the government approached this, and made it harder for them to tie together something that had a kind of overall consistency, a national consistency, when they came to produce the white paper itself.
But the Department for Transport maintain that a regional approach to the process was required because of the complex mix of factors and interactions at every location.
There were a lot of different factors that we had to look at, with a lot of interactions between them. So, for instance, to take a very simple example, the amount of noise that you would get around an airport depended very heavily on the amount of aircraft traffic using that location. And the amount of traffic using the location depended on what development was happening there and at other airports in the area, and what sort of growth of traffic, different types of traffic would be. So, I mean, there were a lot of complex interactions that we had to look at in trying to assess the likely environmental effects. And, of course, looking over a very long time frame of 30 years, which certainly posed some challenges.
The starting point has to be to understand the kinds of developments that might be required, then understand their impacts, and then to try to find the right balance between those two things. I think it's also fair to say that the environmental debate got significantly stronger during what was a long process. And as Mike indicated earlier, what we had to try and do was reflect the strength and changing nature of the environmental debate over the five-year period where we were looking at options, so that by the time we got to that, that had been thoroughly integrated into the final policy.
But Peter Ainsworth thinks that consideration of the environmental impacts of aviation, and in particular climate change, should have been integrated into the process from the start.
I'd like to think that we would have factored in at a much earlier stage the environmental impacts of aviation. I mean, this is the big issue. This is why it's an interesting and also a controversial issue. Because, yes, you know, everyone likes to go on cheap foreign holidays. There's no question about that. But there is a huge environmental cost, not just in terms of the impact on the local environment of noise, of pollution, of deteriorating air quality, of sleepless nights, of land take, biodiversity, all those kind of, the impact on historic buildings that get the National Trust, for example, very excited. But also, of course, in terms of the impact on climate change. Now, in the end, you know, we're either serious about tackling climate change or we're not. And there is no more glaring example that I can think of in terms of today's politics of a failure to join up thinking about climate change with another policy area, in this case, obviously, aviation.
The DFT team contend that they were trying to incorporate a whole range of environmental impacts and mitigating factors into their methodology and modelling exercise, as objectively as possible, so as not to prejudice the eventual outcome in policy terms.
At the outset, it was certainly recognised that we needed to sort of identify the environmental impacts to get a bit more certainty into what had perhaps previously just been a sort of fear of just terrible continuing growth and what does that mean. And people understandably had fears that this would just mean horrendously more noise and horrendously more road traffic and so on. And so it was getting some sort of quantification of that and taking account of likely future technological developments, but also not just sort of accepting a certain sort of rate of improvement of, for instance, aircraft technology, but also trying to understand where we could drive that process to get a better reconciliation between sort of aviation growth and environmental impacts, and to get a sort of lower rate of impact per unit of growth. That was one of the things that we were trying to do.
When we started the process of study, we had to do an awful lot of work to develop a methodology which would allow us to objectively evaluate different kinds of propositions. And that in itself, developing the modelling tools, the analysis frameworks, was quite a significant exercise before you could start looking at ranges of scenarios and options. And critical was that that analysis had to be objective, it had to be thorough, and it had to be capable of standing close scrutiny. We didn't want to come with preconceived ideas as to what the best solution at a particular airport would be. And in some cases, that raised options which were very controversial. But it was very important to not have preconceptions and to be able to basically consult upon the widest possible range and then use the consultation responses we've got to help formulate and frame policy based on a well-founded set of analysis which we could be confident of. We were trying to get, if you like, a robust factual analysis rather than a lot of speculation, to try and give people some facts and real facts and figures rather than a lot of it almost became second or third hand opinions which weren't terribly well founded in terms of the analysis.
So what specific issues did the DfT try to resolve within the process itself?
I think there were perhaps two broad types of issue. There were some broad policy questions and the issue of just how much growth of aviation in the UK should there be, taking account of, on the one hand, the economic benefits from growth of aviation, both for UK businesses increasingly operating on an international and indeed global level, and for sort of attracting inward tourism to the UK. And on the other hand, the clear environmental impacts of aviation at both a local level and at a global level, not least in respect of global warming. So there was a sort of big policy issue there which sort of overlay sort of everything that we were looking at. But also at a sort of more local level, there were sort of trade-offs on the amount of development at a particular airport and the particular location of development, whether it's a new runway or a new terminal. There were clearly, in almost all cases, several options that could be considered with a range of different impacts. And so what we wanted to do at that level was to identify, as far as we could, the sort of the plausible options. Maybe didn't always identify sort of precisely what they might be, but the sort of plausible broad options, and assess the environmental and indeed economic impacts of those options to sort of try and identify, well, you know, if we're going to have any growth at all at this location, what is the more promising sort of option? So it was those two different levels of sort of thinking and activity.
The Environmental Audit Committee also criticised some of the economic benefits which were assumed in the DfT's model.
We have currently in this country a balance of trade deficit in tourism of £15 billion. Now, you build more capacity, more people are going to leave the country, aren't they? I mean, the sums aren't very difficult to work out. It's often argued that we need more capacity because of the tourism industry. Well, actually, the tourism industry is leaving the country and spending money elsewhere. So I don't think that works. When my committee started criticising the government and looking very hard at the way that they'd approached all of this, we discovered that actually there'd been very, very little work done on who was going to be doing all this extra flying around. And ministers kept repeating the mantra, you know, this government is not a government that's going to price people off planes. They hadn't worked out who the people were. Whether the 50% roughly who don't fly at all at the moment were suddenly going to start flying a lot, or whether, given the increased capacity, the 50% who do fly a lot were just simply going to fly more and go to their homes in the south of France or whatever. No analysis had been done about who was actually going to be creating this additional demand. And I think that's a terrible weakness. I mean, these are huge decisions. These are decisions which are going to affect the landscape and the environment for hundreds, if not thousands, of years. They're going to affect communities. They're going to affect where jobs are created. They're going to affect all sorts of infrastructure. And to do that without actually working out who is this for, I think is extraordinary.
There's no doubt that a host of impacts were considered by the DfT during the process, but not, it appears, ways of mitigating the growth in demand for air travel.
A lot of the assessment work was of a wide range of environmental impacts, both at the global level of, I mean, what would be the effect on sort of total levels of emissions of greenhouse gases, through to the effects locally of particular development options on a sort of wide range of different factors, both the sort of natural environment, the built environment, factors affecting people like noise, factors affecting communities, severance, and effects on sort of landscapes and views, effects on things like sort of water supplies. I'm not sure I remember all of them. Pretty wide range of factors. And then, you know, trying to bring that together into a sort of holistic assessment of different options.
We moved away from a predict and provide approach, or thought we had, towards road building. Demand for driving cars is virtually limitless. It's mitigated by price, but it's virtually limitless. And if you try to meet that demand, you'll end up with the whole country one big piece of asphalt covered in cars that aren't moving because there's a traffic jam. So we moved away from that. We don't seem to have a government at the moment that is prepared to move away from predict and provide when it comes to aviation. And that's a mindset. I think that's a mindset within the Department of Transport. And it needs to change.